All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, August 25th, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Thursday, everyone. It is a balmy 71 degrees and very damp here in upstate New York. I woke up this morning and was surprised that it was very wet outside. It looked like we had gotten quite a bit of rain while I was sleeping. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show, and I told you I would do it. It's, quote, unlikely for AI to behave optimally all the time. And that was a quote out of a story we were reading about artificial intelligence and Google and Oxford University putting in a kill switch to be able to stop autonomous robots from killing us all. If that ever happens in the future, we found out not very much from that story that they were planning on it, but that they hadn't figured out how to make the big red button yet. I had mentioned maybe the off switch would be a good one, but they hadn't really given any type of specifics as to how they were going to plan the kill switch. We also looked at some other robots. We had the U.S. Air Force. Actually, we had NASA making the Internet of Things connectivity for firefighters, and there had been a story back from a few weeks ago about them building something similar for police officers to be able to coach them on how to appropriately deal with the public, but that didn't fly too much, so now they're putting it on the firefighters, trying to give them not only insight into the layout of the land that they're walking into during a fire, but also they have biosensors on their equipment and making them have connectivity, potentially screens in front of their face masks or whatever. It's a pretty interesting idea. I think it might help the firefighters, but then again, connecting everything to the Internet of Things is not the direction that we want to go. I mean, yeah, it'll save lives and be non-intrusive. I might be for all that, but I still think that connectivity is destroying us as a society, as a whole. And one of the things, speaking of connectivity, so we ended the show here yesterday, and I really wasn't going to do a whole show on this, but then I started digging into it, and I'm like, ooh, maybe we have to. We ended the show with a story titled, "The U.S. Air Force Plans to Plasma Bomb the Sky to Improve Global Radio Reception." We only read through a couple paragraphs of that, so let's start there, because I guess there is quite a history with these little CubeSats and dumping them into the atmosphere. I had remembered reading a story back a year or so ago. I thought it was Facebook, but I couldn't find that story. I'll have to go through my show titles. There's got to be close to 400 show titles now, but I know I mentioned in the show title for the story we cover, but I did find Google, so we're going to take a look at this. Anyway, the U.S. Air Force plans to plasma bomb the sky to improve global radio reception, and it is so crazy, it might just work, and that is their subtitle. The U.S. Air Force is planning to drop plasma bombs of charged particles into the upper atmosphere, and all in the name of boosting radio reception down on Earth. Now, we all know that there is a project called HARP, and that is not a conspiracy theory. It is in Alaska, at whatever they call it, the University of Alaska, and it was being run in its last days before they rebooted it and handed over administration to the university. In its last days, DARPA had signed up to do a few experiments up there, and then they quote-unquote shut it down. And then we find out, oh no, DARPA's running it now for a little bit, and they're going to be doing some sort of classified experiments. And when they're done, no, it won't be over. Like we told you it was going to be. We're going to hand it to the University of Alaska, and that's what they did. But for years, they had been doing this oral research of pumping low frequency, because that's what I had always read it was, low frequency, but who knows? Who knows what those antennas could do up there? It was a very large array of antennas. They were pumping frequencies into the atmosphere to be able to do who knows what. Now, I had heard a couple interviews over the last month or so that gave me some tip-offs as to what potentially is going on up there. I found out there was one interview that was from Tim Kelly's show, I believe, that was talking about back in the days of not only Operation Paperclip, but the Manhattan Project. And as part of the Manhattan Project, they had been experimenting with the atmosphere. They were experimenting with being able to direct particles in the atmosphere. And their first experiments, being with GE and being with the Manhattan Project, were radionuclides. Now, interestingly enough, thinking that GE is also really big in the reactor market, and hey, the GE reactor that melted down in Fukushima, the big one, that was reactor number 3. I think actually that was the one that blew up like a nuclear bomb. That was a GE reactor. So, I don't know. Color me silly that I see any type of even dotted lines between them. But it just seemed pretty interesting. So anyway, HARP is not a conspiracy theory. HARP has been up there for a very long time. So it is not too much of a stretch of the imagination to take a look now at these CubeSats. The U.S. Air Force is planning to drop plasma bombs of charged particles into the upper atmosphere, all in the name of boosting radio reception down here on Earth. Wink. Small satellites called CubeSats, measuring just a few centimeters cubed, would be used for the project, and researchers in 3 separate teams are now figuring out how to get it done. The biggest challenge is going to be fitting plasma generators onto small orbiting CubeSats and then controlling how the plasma is dispersed. Now, on the ground, you might have something like a wide array of antennas to do that. I don't know. Again, color me silly. Especially when we look at, we have this coming of the drones from all big tech manufacturers, Amazon, including Walmart even. And they are determining how they're going to do air traffic control for these swarms of drones that are coming in our future. And we discovered that Verizon and NASA are the two crown jewels that are going to be working together on this. But there are 35 other, and this was probably as of 6 months ago, there might even be more now, 35 other tech and shopping companies that all want to work together, including Amazon, to be able to do air traffic control for drones. Well, you know, we already, they own the ground for logistics. Now they're going to own the middle atmosphere for logistics. We have the FAA that owns the upper areas of the atmosphere for not only airplanes and other air traffic. Then we have NASA and the FAA owning the upper levels of the atmosphere. We found out just recently that it was the FAA who approved a private company to be able to go up to the moon. And I believe this is starting in 2017. To be able to go up onto the moon and be the very first private company to begin mining the moon for precious natural resources. Now, first of all, whoever told us that the moon was ours to take at will and take the riches for a private company? Don't we all own the moon? I would think, being a citizen of Earth, we should all potentially own 1/7 billionth 1/7 billionth of the moon, because we really should. But no, the FAA somehow has dubbed themselves the owners of the moon and has given permission to a private company to land and exploit its resources. I found it. It's a Scientific American from August 3rd. Private company cleared for moon landing in 2017. Government approves robot mission for Moon Express, which wants to mine our satellite. For the first time ever, a private company has permission to land on the moon, and the U.S. government has officially approved the planned 2017 robotic lunar landing of California-based Moon Express, which aims to fly commercial missions to the moon's nearest neighbor, to the Earth's nearest neighbor, and help exploit its resources, the company representatives announced today, August 3rd. This is not only a milestone, but really a threshold for the entire commercial space industry. Yeah, the one we didn't know we had, but apparently we do now, says Moon Express's co-founder and CEO, Bob Richards, to space.com. Previously, companies had been able to operate only on or around Earth, and the new approval, which is exclusive to Moon Express, could therefore, and how did Moon Express get exclusive approval, I'd like to know. Slippery palms and butt patting, I'm sure. While too exclusive to Moon Express, could therefore serve as an important regulatory guide for deep space commercial activity in general. Nobody's had a deep space voyage yet. We are still charting those waters, he said, but somebody had to be first. Moon Express submitted an application to, and this is what I was saying, ding, the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, on April 8th. The document then made its way through the U.S. State Department. These are all very interesting groups. The U.S. Department of Defense, NASA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, and the Federal Communications Commission, as well as the FAA. And the interagency approval took some time. Not because anybody was against or adverse to this, he said. It's just that we asked questions that had never been asked before, that had to be addressed and all worked out. So Moon Express can now focus exclusively on the financial and technical challenges of the 2017 moon mission, which will begin with the launch of the company's MX-1 lander atop a Rocket Lab Electron booster. Moon Express signed a multi-launch deal with Rocket Lab last year. And interesting that they did not involve Jeff Bezos' Amazon or Elon Musk's SpaceX. Very, very interesting. We need to look up who this Rocket Lab Electron booster, what this is all about and who Rocket Lab is. I haven't heard of them yet. The main goal of this maiden launch is to test out the MX-1's performance and capabilities on the lunar surface. And Moon Express representatives also hope to win, and yes, we should have known it, the Google Lunar X Prize, which is a $30 million competition to land a privately funded robotic vehicle on the moon by the end of 2017. So we knew Google had to be involved in here somewhere. I know I'd read about that Google Lunar X, but I didn't realize that it was to land something on the moon by the end of 2017. So it is Google and their $30 million that they are offering as a dangling carrot to start getting companies to send projects to take advantage of the moon. And it appears that even though it's never been done before, the FAA, the U.S. State Department, the U.S. Defense Department, NASA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Institute, more affectionately known as NOAA, and the Federal Communication Commission is all on board. But again, like I said, who owns the moon? Who says that we own the moon? I know China and India and Israel and a bunch of other entities have all been planning on going to the moon. And now I guess this Moon Express as well. But who owns the moon? What gives anyone the right to go mining the moon? And I'm interested to know whether Google's XPRIZE is just for places in the United States or if it is a global competition. We'll have to look at that. There's actually a story here, maybe after we're done with this one we can look at that. But I want to get to those little sap cubes too. The first team to pull off this landing and get the vehicle to move at least 1,640 feet or 500 meters on the lunar surface and then beam a high-definition video and photos back to Earth will win the grand prize of $20 million. The second team to achieve all of this gets $5 million, and another $5 million is available for meeting other milestones. At this moment, there are now 16 teams in the running. 16, guys. 16 people shooting for the moon. We're still shooting for the end of 2017, Richard said of the maiden MX-1 moon mission. A lot has to go right, but at least we have a shot at our moonshot, given this regulatory approval from all these different entities. It's pretty insane. If all goes according to plan, future Moon Express missions will help access, extract, and exploit lunar resources such as water ice, helping to launch new era in space exploration, and other things, company representatives have said. And all I'm thinking in my head is, hey, that Disney moon base that I asked many times, where the hell is it, after all these years, might just become a reality. Especially, you know, they were talking about the Playboy Bunny Mansion in space quite a few years ago. I don't know if you saw Hugh Hefner sold the Bunny Mansion to his next door neighbor for something like $100 million. So there is no more Bunny Mansion. So it might be time to get kicking it on the moon. Space travel is our only path forward to ensure our survival. Yeah, after we fuck this planet up so bad and we're getting ready to launch the biological apocalypse, we better be getting off this rock quick. Remember, I told you, that is the end plan. And it's not for us. Oh, no, no. You might be one of the people picked to go on the very first Mars mission when we don't know what's up there and it's going to screw up your bodily proportions because of their messed up gravity and you'll never be able to return. And there might even be brain-eating amoebas. We don't quite know yet. Yeah, you might be able to go on that off-world mission, but not on any of the ones that have been approved for royalty and rich people. And that's the one with the good food, not the bug protein. Anyway, space travel is our only path forward to ensure our survival and to create a limitless future for our children, says Moon Express co-founder and chairman Naveen Jain in a statement today. And in the intermediate future, we envision bringing precious resources, metals, and moon rocks back to Earth. You know, don't worry about it. Don't worry that there might be any moon virus up there that we don't want to bring back here to Earth, because we're not going to do it in any type of bio level 4 facility. I mean, what? How is this? I mean, I would hope that they would, but we apparently are seeing that any of these technologies, because I'll tell you, I look long and hard, and I did not see much of any type of biosecurity in any of these pictures that I saw. And maybe they were just staged, you know. I'll give them that little inkling of a doubt there. But in any pictures that I've seen and any stories that I've read about biotech and some of the mad science they're doing in labs, I have not read about any type of high-level 4 security. No face masks. They got little lateral gloves on. Yep, pretty and blue. That's a nice matchup with their little white coats that they wear and their shiny little goggles. But besides that, I'm not seeing any type of mouth coverage. I mean, maybe they got an N95, but then who knows what we're dealing with, biologically engineered to be Trojan horses and circumvent immune systems or whatever. I mean, you would think that this would be treated at least as half-assed as anthrax and smallpox, which is supposed to be under high-level security, and we find out isn't really either. But how scary is this? So let's just bring back precious resources, metals, and moon rocks from another heavenly body that we haven't been up there since 1971 or two to explore and have no freaking idea, really, since we didn't have the technology back then to be looking at things microscopically or with electron microscopes. But hey, we're pretty sure there's nothing up there that's gonna like eat humans or anything like that. Like, how insane, guys. This is like playing chicken from a thousand different directions and then rolling the dice to see what the big apocalypse is gonna be. We're the next superbug. Something that could wipe us all out because it's never been here before. Hey, don't worry. It'll be quick. It won't be that painful. In 15 years, the moon will be an important part of Earth's economy and potentially our second home. Now, speaking about our second homes, there was another story. And I really didn't want to get on alternate Earths, but there was another story from last night. It was a big announcement. Right at our nearest star, they discovered an Earth-like planet in the Goldilocks zone. And if you can hold the phone just for 1 second, I don't know, I published a few things since last night. I have it up here somewhere. If I can't find it, we might have to save it for tomorrow, but I thought it would be a good segue. Oh, come on, come on, come on. Here it is. Confirmed! An Earth-like planet has been found in our closest neighboring star system. Science Alert, August 24th, 2016. The European Southern Observatory has finally confirmed that they've discovered a new exoplanet candidate named Proxima B. And I thought they had mentioned that one before. Maybe they have just now finally confirmed it 100%. Inside of the habitable zone of Proxima Centauri, which is a red dwarf. So this is gigantic news, because it means that there is an Earth-like planet that could lie just 4.2 light years away from us. 4.2 light years, hey. And it has the potential to support life. Further research is needed to confirm the characteristics of its atmosphere and the possibility of liquid water on its surface. But the team already has plans on how to get us there. Hey, hey, hey. Many exoplanets have been found, and many more will be found, but searching for the closest potential Earth analog and succeeding has been the experience of a lifetime for all of us, says team member Guillaume Elgan Iskchut from Queen Mary University in London. Named Proxima B, the exoplanet candidate orbits Proxima Centauri, a red dwarf that lies within the Alpha Centauri system in the constellation Centaurus, and it is the closest star system to Earth, making Proxima B the closest Earth-like exoplanet ever found. This is really exciting because the proximity can't get any better, says one of the team, Michael Endel, from the University of Texas at Austin. This team, which includes researchers from the ESO and a program called the Pale Red Dot Campaign, was able to find the new planet candidate by observing Proxima Centauri in the first half of 2016 and comparing their data with previous observations from the past 16 years collected by telescopes all over the world. In collating 16 years worth of data, ding, it's all in a database, people, they found enough statistical evidence for the existence of Proxima B, and I kept checking the consistency of every signal every single day during 60 nights of the Pale Red Dot campaign, and first 10 were promising. The first 20 were consistent with expectations, and at 30 days, the results were pretty much definitive, so we started drafting the paper. What we know about Proxima B so far is that it is roughly 1.3 times the size of Earth, and there is a good chance that it is a rocky planet. It orbits roughly 4.3 million miles from Proxima Centauri, and it takes about 11.2 days to complete its orbit. So the days on this planet are only, or the months on this planet are only 11.2 days, or are the years? Wait a minute. If it orbits the sun in 11.2 days, that's a year. 11.2 days is a year. Well, that's pretty messed up. Not much of a growing season then, I would imagine. Its surface temperature is about minus 40 degrees Celsius, so I don't think there would be much of a growing season. And there is also the possibility that it harbors an atmosphere in liquid water on its surface at minus 40 degrees Celsius. How is that possible? Unless it was very frozen liquid water, something that would be key for life to form on this planet. Further observations are needed to confirm this, but fortunately, the team says Proxima B is in range of probes, which means one day in the not-so-distant future, we could be sending a spacecraft out there to take pictures. It's only 4.2 light years. And check this out. The team also plans to team up with who? Mark Zuckerberg, Stephen Hawking, and yes, Russian billionaire Yuri Milner. And we read about this. They were the ones that were looking at sending, again, those little mini satellites with umbrellas on them. And I thought they were CubeSats, as a matter of fact, out to go find us another Earth. Well, they're going to team up with these guys, including Zuckermucker, their team, who announced the $130 million project called Starshot earlier this year, that will send tiny spacecrafts to where? Oh, Alpha Centauri, in hopes of finding life. The Starshot team hopes to get their tiny spacecraft out to Alpha Centauri within the next 30 years. And as the project continues, as well as the ESOs, we will hopefully figure out much more about Proxima B. Proxima B is indeed our neighbor, says the team. So let's get used to it. So guys, we now have another potential Earth only 4.2 light years away. 4.2, not 4.2 million. I'm pretty certain I read 4.2 light years. Hold on, I'm looking. Let's make certain of that, because that was very close. 4.2, come on. I can't see it. I'm gonna sing until I see it. My computer is moving real slow now. It's 1.3 times the size of Earth. Its orbit is 4.3 million miles from Proxima Centauri. It takes 11.2 days to complete its orbit. And I'm pretty sure it's said. I can't see it. Hold on, guys. Hold on. We're going to do a search. Light years. Here we go. No, not enlightenment. Let's go up. Not there. No, let's go up. 4.2. It was right at the beginning. Light years away from us. It is. It's just 4.2 light years. So anyway, again, another thing that was interesting about this, and I had thought that it was the same star system. That was Zuckermucker's Hawking and that Russian billionaire for that Starshot project where they were going to send all those mini satellites to go searching. I want to take a look at that, because then we're going to get into these CubeSats. These CubeSats that apparently they have been spewing into our atmosphere, upper atmosphere, for a very long time. Now, when I plugged in the search term, it brought up the Google X project, and that is not what I want. Oh, well. I'm going to give it up here. This computer's moving so slow, I can't even click. So, all right, skip it. We'll look at it tomorrow. Okay, so now that we have established that there's a private company going to the moon, and that we have now found our closest potential replacement Earth is 4.2 light years away, and that Mark Zuckerberg, Stephen Hawking, and Russian billionaire Yuri Milner announced a $130 million project to spew little tiny spacecraft into the atmosphere and send it to Alpha Centauri in the hopes of finding life. And that the U.S. Air Force is planning on launching lots and lots of little CubeSats into the sky to plasma bomb it to improve global radio reception. There was a story from about 10 days ago. Scientists are launching. This isn't the Air Force. These are scientists now. Scientists are launching from August 17th, 2016, 50 mini satellites to study our atmosphere's outermost layer. One part of our atmosphere that we know very little about. An international team of scientists is getting ready to launch 50 mini satellites called CubeSats again into our Earth's thermosphere, the outermost layer of our atmosphere that we know relatively little about. Finding out more about the thermosphere, which is situated between 200 and 380 kilometers above the Earth's surface, is crucial because we rely on it to protect us from the harsh conditions of space. Yeah, like radiation and such, I'm sure. And you know, here's something else that's interesting, guys. There are bacteria that they have discovered in some of these upper layers of our atmosphere that have never before been seen. They really make you wonder, some of these recent research missions that they've done with balloons, collecting samples, they've done those very high altitude balloons that were collecting samples and recording sounds and stuff. They've been finding some really crazy stuff already. So now let's just go all balls out and everybody start launching mini satellites to do who the hell knows what up there and bring shit back down to Earth. Hey, what do you got to lose? Who are you going to blame? I don't know. Something crazy gets out, man. Blame it on the private space company that we sent up to the moon, sending back rocks and stuff. I mean, how insane is this? Instead of sending the 50 mini satellites up into the thermosphere from Earth, they will be launched from the International Space Station, and their job will be to feed back data on how our outer atmosphere functions. Now, we apparently have already sent men to the moon. But you mean to tell me we didn't study our outer atmosphere at all? We've had the space shuttle and the International Space Station going up there since the 80s. That was a space shuttle. Space station maybe since the 90s. I don't remember when that started. But at least space shuttle since the 80s. And we haven't at all done any studying of the outer atmosphere. Maybe. Maybe we just float around out there and put spiders and plants on the space shuttle. I don't know, for experiments. How could we not have been studying and feeding back data on how the outer atmosphere works all these years? I mean, it's been like 30 years, right? This region of the atmosphere is poorly understood and really hard to measure. And yet, it is the interface between our planet and space, says Andrew Dempster, one of a team from the University of New South Wales in Australia, one of our mad science universities, an extension of the U.S. where we do crazy stuff. It is where Much of the ultraviolet and X-ray radiation from the sun collides with Earth and generates auras of potential hazards that can affect our power grids and communications. These 50 CubeSats are part of an international project called QB50, involving researchers from 28 countries, including Europe, Japan, the U.S., and Australia. The CubeSats are tiny satellites measuring approximately 10 centimeters on each side. 10 centimeters, guys, that's really tiny. And weighing about a kilogram each. It's an exciting move for Australia in particular, which is one of the only countries without a space agency. The three Australian satellites are named UNSW.EC0, Inspire-2W, and SUSAT. UNSW-EC0 will study atomic composition of the thermosphere, while Inspire 2, which is a joint project between the University of Sydney, the University of New South Wales, and the Australia National University, will measure the electron temperature and the density of plasma in the region. Well, don't worry about that, because the U.S. Air Force will screw those readings up by plasma bombing the atmosphere. What the hell? Yeah, I wonder if they're going to figure out how much plasma ends up in the upper thermosphere after they plasma bomb the lower atmosphere to improve radio reception. And the satellites will operate for 3 to 9 months, which may last up to a year, orbiting in this little studied region of space before their orbits decay and they re-enter the atmosphere and burn up it like little projectiles. I added the projectile part. The researchers are excited about the potential data collected by the 50 satellites. And the best part is that CubeSats are a lot cheaper to launch than large satellites, which mean that you get more data for your money. If you put one very expensive large satellite up, you'll get one data set. And it will be it. And it'll cost you an awful lot of money. But if you have 50 satellites, you get 50 data sets that hasn't cost you much money at all. And that being said, these satellites still aren't cheap, costing $750,000 each to produce. Well, they should get that the Weiss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering that makes the origami to start building you cheap little 10 centimeter by 10 centimeter by 10 centimeter little mini cubes. And the actual launch date is scheduled for December 2016. And they will be sent to the International Space Station using the orbital ATK Antares rocket that blasts off from Wallop Islands, Virginia. They will then take about a month to be deployed from the ISS. Drifting down from the ISS's 380-kilometer orbit to the lower regions of the thermosphere. Bring it on in January, because we are excited to see what these mini satellites can find. Now, can you imagine? We'll have to dig up that story about some of the strange bacteria and stuff that they were finding up there. But could you imagine if they found, like, space microbes? I mean, we've potentially postulated, if anyone's ever seen the Tether incident on YouTube, and I believe that was a space shuttle mission. Space shuttle would be STS in the title. But if you search STS and then you search Tether incident, you will see what I am talking about. It was a project to see if they could send rockets up to space, low Earth orbit, utilizing a highly charged tether, whether it be a wire or some sort of carbon, nanocarbon material. I don't know what the tether was made out of, but it was highly electrified. They were going to use it like a space elevator. And they were doing this experiment, and the tether broke while it was highly electrified. They had the space shuttle's cameras aimed on it in space. and you see this electrified broken tether out in space, and then you start to see, first of all, you start to question what you're looking at, whether you're looking at outer space or whether you're looking at a microscope under a petri dish with maybe some liquid and some creatures in there, because the next thing you notice are all these flashing things at varying different levels of luminosity and opacity that are all swarming toward this broken, highly electrified tether in outer space. And then the camera zooms in. Then you can see these things very clearly, and you go, oh, holy shit, what is that? Gotta tell you, out of any conspiracy, anything about life being in space that I've ever seen, that tether incident, which was a direct NASA feed, has probably been the crown jewel of anything that I've ever seen to question that maybe, just maybe, in space, there could be life living microbially like we have in our oceans or in our waterways, like we have amoebas, like space amoebas. That's what my husband called them. And they actually locomote, and you can see almost inside some of them, and you will see whether it's liquid or energy or whatever the hell it is inside of them is pulsating. Check it out. I will put a link to maybe one of those clips in the notes of the show, but it is the STS space shuttle mission. I don't remember what year it was from. It's probably the early to mid-90s. So it'll be STS and then tether incident. You will find it. All right, anyway, to get back to more of these satellites, so they're looking for something. They're sending a commercial mission in 2017 to the moon. We are now potentially looking at an Earth-like planet that is only 4.2 light years from us, and that team is going, the European team is going to partner with Zuckerberg, Hawking, and Russian millionaire to send some exploratory satellites out that way. And now we got the Air Force and scientists and the space station all launching mini CubeSat satellites all over our upper atmosphere looking for something. Well, it gets even better, guys. August 9th, 2016, and these are all within the last week, so how amazing. Kepler, the Kepler mission. This is Kepler Communications. I don't know if they're related to the Kepler mission. Kepler was, they put out one of the satellites that went way, way, way out there. Kepler, says this is Kepler Communications, gets $5 million. This is from August 9th, 2016. Kepler gets $5 million to launch a network of football-sized Internet of Things networked satellites. Guys, the Internet of Things is now going to be across our sky. Thank you, Mr. Dan Cooper. That is the tether incident in chat. Kepler Communications has raised $5 million in seed funding to create a network of small, easily replaced satellites to create a real-time network through the Internet of Things, more affectionately known as IoT. Internet Things devices that can communicate, essentially building a cellular network in space through which machinery and equipment can talk to one another and what an interesting term, to its handlers. Ding, ding. You can think of it as a cell phone tower network in space, but not to serve my phone or your phone, but to serve any machine or asset in operation, says co-founder and CEO Mina Mintry, explaining about Kepler's product in an interview. Now, when we start looking at the story we looked at yesterday, China and South Korea going all crazy, being able to build robots and artificial intelligence that can be deployed anywhere. And we already looked at Baxter with cloud learning and connecting all devices to the Internet of Things, which will become the Internet of Everything, we found out. And she talks about how we can connect any machine or any asset in operation to this future networked satellite Internet of Things. Guys, the bag is closed. It's over. We have been now trapped on planet Earth. There will be no getting off this rock for you or me. Nope, nope, nope. Bagged and tagged and tracked from a space level. Don't forget that anything that can be used to surveil can be used as a weapon, can be used in telemetry, and could be used to enslave. This is not for planet Earth's benefit at all. And it's all being given to corporations to be able to control and then work with the governments of the world. This is corporotechnocracy, transhumanist crazy, gone completely off the rails. So if you, and this is our example, so if you're a tractor doing mining operations in the middle of nowhere, you can use our network to relay information about the health and wellness of the tractor. Think about this too. If you're a robo-bee, and this is my insertion, you're a robo-bee out working the fields, pollinating GMO corn crops, just like you were told, sending your data up to our little CubeSats. We can then call on you when there is a surveillance emergency. I don't know. We need you to go take a look in the field over yonder, bzz, little robo-bees. We're going to send you the signal real time from our little CubeSat satellites and swarms of biologically inspired engineering from Weiss Institute can go zipping over to Farmer Brown's field and check out what is munching on the alfalfa. I mean, guys, I can't even comprehend all the craziness that can come out of this. And I mean, not saying we don't have satellites already up there. You can go, there's a plugin for Google Earth. I don't remember what the plugin is called, but you can search it. Those plugins are called, have an extension of KMZ, Kathy Mary Zoo. So if you search satellite KMZ in Google, you probably will be able to find it. And then you just run this little KMZ when you are in Google Earth, and you will be able to see Earth from a distance and every satellite that's around it. And it literally looks like there's a junk pile around planet Earth. You can zoom in on them, and it'll give you the statistics on whose satellite is whose, who's doing what with it, unless it's military. Some of those will show, and some will just be kind of blank of most of it, but it'll tell you who owns it anyway. But there's already millions of satellites and tons of satellite junk up there. But what makes this different is that this is going to fully integrate to the Internet of Things intentionally, as opposed to being many disparate networks, number one. And number two, these are going to be cheap to launch comparatively. They'll be able to launch them on the fly, dump them from any of these commercialized space missions in the future, or launch them from any of these commercialized pay-as-you-play rocket launches that are going on by places like SpaceX and Jeff Bezos. The Kepler network, which uses an array of small satellites called CubeSats, in industry vernacular, could also provide the data connection necessary for the International Space Station to send back photos to Earth, says Mintry. Basically, Kepler hopes to handle any type of communication where it would be difficult to speak to connected machinery and devices using traditional terrestrial cellular networks. You know, I really want to look into this Kepler communications and see who funded them and who they are related to. And I keep seeing someone in chat mentioning the Gremlins. Yeah, the Gremlins were a DARPA project for some of these autonomous sky drones. And we also had Facebook and Google working on 5G to be able to spread internet to every nook and cranny of the planet to make sure that even the tribes in Africa have the benefit of connecting to the global community of Facebook and other social media. And it even says it is a bit like what Facebook and Google are trying to do with their efforts to bring internet connections to rural areas. But Mintry says Kepler is focused on machine-to-machine communications exclusively for now. So that is enabling the whole back end of the Internet of Things globally. Since technical limitations of its satellites would make it difficult to do things like host real-time voice communications. Mintry also cites the much higher growth potential of commercialized Internet of Things communications versus traditional cellular data networks as a reason to focus their offerings. You've probably heard the expression hardware is hard as it pertains to startups, so it stands to reason that space hardware is harder, but Mintry has space credibilities. He completed both his undergraduate degree and his partial PhD studies in aerospace engineering, and he worked at the aerospace manufacturer Pratt Whitney after school. And after working in a number of startups, including director of engineering at T-Bot, a startup making full-service kiosks to brew and dispense loose-leaf tea. Yeah, I'm sure that gives you the credentials. Mintry decided to found his own company, and Kepler Communication was born. We are setting up to have our first two satellite launches at the end of 2017, although details about their launch partner will be revealed later on, so we don't know who's launching these puppies yet. It'll be interesting to see who they partner with. And by the end of this year, 2016, they will be ready to do the important work of testing the hardware they've designed in Earth's upper atmosphere, which should provide important data about space-based performance. Well, if they're saying by the end of this year, then I'm wondering if they aren't going to be launched by the space station as part of that Australian global test we just read about. Attracting investment was not easy, said Mintry, because a lot of investors balk at the idea that a startup can create a product used for space. But he also says the climate is changing, and luckily there's been a huge shot in the cost of creating space-based technology thanks to moving away from huge expensive satellite infrastructure that was designed for a decade or so of use, with costs that you needed to amortize over time. Small and expensive CubeSat-based designs mean the spending barrier for building satellites is much lower, and because of the standardization of things like form factor and the reduction of launch costs, there's a whole host of things that are contributing, and it is now in the range of tons of startups to have space-based operations. Now, we could even read more. There was a story that came out in 2013 about them launching CubeSats. NASA is offering launch opportunity to anyone with a CubeSat. So that's what makes me wonder as to whether or not these two projects, the NASA International Space Station CubeSat launch that's being done for science and the CubeSat launch that's being done for Kepler Communications to enable the Internet of Things in upper orbit, aren't part of the same project as we see NASA offering to let everybody's stuff go. But there was another story, and this might be where we'll have to end it until tomorrow. And tomorrow we're going to have a special guest toward the end of the show. If anyone remembers from Truth or Talk, Verstein Henry. Verstein messaged she'd like to come on and talk for a little bit. She moved and started a new life and started her own new career, has released an album. I'd like to share that with us. We're going to have Verstein on tomorrow, probably for the last half hour or so of the show. But this is where we're going to kick it off tomorrow. Satellites could one day double to provide internet and self-aware algorithms. Ding. To Google's customers. This is a story, June 10th, 2014. Google buys Skybox and Nets HD imaging capabilities. Google spent much of 2013 and 14 on a tear with aggressive acquisitions, and now it's made another bold bid, scooping up Skybox Imaging, which is a satellite imaging firm. According to Recode, the deal is worth $500 million, and talks reportedly began in April of 2014, but it wasn't until Skybox scored $70 million in a May venture capital funding round that Google lofted such a substantial valuation. One of Google's best-selling points of its search engine was its tightly integrated Google Earth service, but now they can do high definition resolution and accomplish even more exotic goals. Google Earth is currently stitched together from low resolution satellites, but now with their purchase, they'll be able to get HD with Skybox. Skybox, as the name might imply, employs what? Oh, tiny box-shaped satellites. Oh my goodness, where have we heard about that? To provide its own in-house imaging capabilities. Based in Mountain View, California, this company was founded by Stanford University graduate students. Oh, just like Google. But this one was in 2009. Skybox's fleet consists of microsatellites, which draw their inspiration from CubeSats, and it would be appropriate to refer to traditional CubeSat designs as nanosatellites, and Skybox, they're referring to theirs as microsatellites. So guys, the CubeSat comes of age. The roots of Skybox imaging lie in the CubeSat protocol of 1999, and we are going to blanket the atmosphere to be able to not only high definition image you, but to beam you algorithms to all of your equipment and gear all across the planet. Well, not really sure where my bumper is, but it is Thursday. So make sure you stick around because Mr. Kevin Blanch is live up next. All kinds of live radio, brand new Chuck Ocelli and Ron Gaiman and SM Gibson. Have an awesome Thursday. I will catch up with you tomorrow. Everybody take care.
This is Ozzy Skateboard and EV.